Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend. Three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. On Sunday night, you might have noticed when Daniela Vega made history at the Academy Awards ceremony when she became the first transgender presenter at, at the Oscars. With us now is another transgender woman who has many firsts to her credit. Sarah McBride was the first trans person to speak at a national political convention. That was the 2016 Democratic one. Before that, she interned at the White House. Again, the first transgender person to do so. In a new memoir, Sarah McBride writes about her journey and how her gender identity shaped her politics. She is now the National Press Secretary at the Human Rights Campaign, the leading LGBTQ civil rights organization. Her book is called Tomorrow Will Be Different: Love, Loss, and the Fight for Trans Equality. Sarah, thanks so much for coming in. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
Your book starts off at a very critical moment in your life. You're in college. You're in a frat. Were you the student body president yet?
Yes, it was during my term as student body president.
And
it was really through that experience that I was able to gain the courage, the confidence, and the insights that I needed to finally accept that fact that I had known about myself my entire life, that I'm a transgender woman. I came out to my parents on Christmas Day in 2011, and fortunately, with their support and the support of family and friends around me, on the last day of my term as student body president at American University, I came out to the broader campus and to the world as transgender in the student newspaper.
Given what we usually think of as the mindsets of frat brothers, how did your frat brothers deal with it?
You know, I was fortunate enough that when I was in a fraternity trying to prove to myself and to other people something that I knew I wasn't, that I joined a fraternity filled with a lot of loving, compassionate people. A lot of gay men were in the fraternity. And so when I came out, they responded with nothing but love and support. I remember when I first posted my coming out note and the comments started flooding in, I got a knock on the door to my office in the student government office. And I opened the door and there were about 10 fraternity brothers standing there with their arms open, ready to give me a hug, to make clear that while I may not be their fraternity brother anymore, I'd always be their sister.
So we shouldn't stereotype frat brothers any more than any other group as a group.
This is definitely a group that defies the stereotypes.
What prompted you to come out at that particular point in your life? Were there specific events that led up to it?
You know, I think it was the culmination of 21 years of struggle. I am someone who has known that they're transgender my entire life. I remember some of my earliest memories lying in my bed at night praying that I would wake up the next day and be myself. And I think the challenge—
And be a girl.
Yes. And I think the challenge for transgender rights in a way that differs with the fight for gay, lesbian, and bisexual rights is that it's difficult for the non-transgender population, cisgender people, to empathize with the experience of having a gender identity that differs from your sex assigned at birth. And for me, it felt like a constant feeling of homesickness, that unwavering ache in the pit of my stomach that would only go away when I could be seen and affirmed as myself. And unlike geographic homesickness, which dissipates with time and getting used to your new surroundings, this homesickness only grew with distance. And so after 21 years of that homesickness eventually becoming so all-consuming that I thought about it every single waking hour of every single day, I realized that I couldn't continue to watch my life pass by not living my life.
And listeners, we invite your phone calls with maybe your own coming out stories. If you're trans or anything else you want to say or ask of Sarah McBride, who is press secretary for the Human Rights Campaign, LGBTQ activist group, but also now the author of Tomorrow Will Be Different: Love, Loss, and the Fight for Trans Equality. You write about being aware very early, and you just said that again now, that somehow you felt like a girl before you knew what transgender was, like with the two sisters in your neighborhood who you played dress up with. Can you tell that story?
Sure. You know, I remember going over to a friend's house, Courtney and Stephanie Seitz, when I was 5 or 6. And away from the parents up in the playroom, I would put on the Disney princess dresses that they had. And my favorite one was a Cinderella dress. And I just remember in putting those dresses on and being sort of seen as myself, a longing and an incompleteness that I didn't fully understand at that point, but that longing and completeness going away. But it wasn't until I was 10 years old and I was watching a sitcom with a transgender guest character that I, one, found out that this was something that other people experienced, that there was something I could do about it. But also at the same time, it became clear to me as the laugh track cued every single time a character would express any kind of interest in that beautiful transgender character that I'd also potentially be a joke if I came out. And at 10 years old, you don't know a lot, but you know you don't want to be a joke.
That's such an interesting story from the early part of your book. Being a kid who's experiencing what turn out to be transgender feelings, and the first time you heard the word transgender, it was watching a sitcom with your mom.
Yeah. And I remember looking over at her and asking my mother, you know, is that real? Are there people like that? And she said, yes, sort of nonchalantly. They're called transgender or something like that. And it was both life-affirming in finding out this piece of information, but also my heart dropped as I looked at her and knew, oh my God, I'm going to have to tell you this someday, and you're going to be so scared and disappointed.
So when did you come out to your family, and how did they respond?
It was in late 2011 on Christmas Day. I remember the previous evening, Christmas Eve, being in church, listening to the choir in the Presbyterian church that I had grown up in sing O Holy Night and looking up at the stained glass windows and just knowing that I couldn't continue to let this beauty escape me, that I wasn't truly living in the present, I wasn't truly living my life, and that I needed to come out.
And so you were already in college then?
I was in college. I was a junior in college. It was in the middle of my term as a student body president. And I told myself I'm going to come out after Christmas. But my mother, noticing as the empathetic person that she is that something was wrong, she came to me after we opened presents and said, "You seem so down. What's wrong?" And I thought, I have the courage to say it right now. I have the confidence to say it right now. And I told her that I was transgender. And they were so scared when I came out, scared of rejection in every sense of the word. And I knew that this would be a response from them. And they made clear that they loved me and supported me. But my mom expressed this feeling that I was dying, that they were losing their child. Because I would look.
They were losing their son and gaining a daughter.
And that's what I told them, that they were keeping the child that they've always loved and gaining a daughter in the process. But it was difficult in that moment to really internalize that. And particularly because I hadn't started actually living my life as myself, it seems sort of so abstract and in the future. And my mother, you know, she in the first couple of days, she asked my oldest brother, who's an openly gay man, she said, "What are the chances that I have a gay child and a transgender child?" And my brother, who's a radiation oncologist, said, "Mom, what are the chances that a child is diagnosed with terminal cancer? Your child is not dying. They're not going anywhere. You're not losing your child. This will be okay." And I think he needed to push back. And from my perspective, I wanted my parents to eventually get to a place where they were asking that question, "What are the chances?" Not out of pity, but out of awe. Awe in the diversity of our family, awe in the strength of the children that they raised who are able to live their authentic lives.
And it must be weird for a parent. Do you think it's different? Is this too general a question? Do you think it's different for a parent to deal with their child coming out as gay or lesbian than as transgender?
Absolutely. And particularly when I came out 6 years ago, before the sort of, quote, transgender tipping point that we have experienced, my parents made very clear when my brother came out that they loved him and accepted him. And they made very clear to me that they loved me and they accepted me. But when my brother came out, they knew gay people. They had reference points for people who were gay, who had partners and were successful in their careers. And they didn't really have that comparative reference for transgender people. All they had was what I had, which was the references of a punchline in a comedy or a dead body in a drama.
So where do you think we are? You talked about a trans tipping point. Is it possible to compare to gay and lesbian rights and general societal acceptance, sort of where we are on that scale? You know, is it 1970? Is it 1980? Is it possible to draw a connection?
Yeah, I actually think, I think oftentimes we have people say that they think on trans rights we're in the 80s or 90s. And I think that that's far too pessimistic of a take. I think on trans rights, we are probably around 2005 and 2006, right after that marriage backlash. Just as I think the progressive movement and the Democratic Party and I think, frankly, fair-minded Americans were beginning to regret the experience of opposing gay rights and opposing marriage equality. And just at the beginning point of that really broader acceptance by fair-minded Americans, by progressives, by moderates of gay rights as a legitimate issue of civil and human rights.
My guest is Sarah McBride, author of Tomorrow Will Be Different, Love, Loss, and the Fight for Trans Equality, 212-433-WNYC. If you want to tell your own story or ask Sarah a question, 212-433-9692. And Anna in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Anna.
Hi, how are you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to extend, Sarah, like a happy Women's Day tomorrow and all transgender women, a happy Women's Day. I think we don't do enough. I'm straight, but we don't do enough for inclusion, so I just wanted to do my part.
Well, thank you, and happy Women's Day, International Women's Day to you. I think it's so important that we recognize the diversity of womanhood, and I think womanhood and this world is enhanced by the diversity, by the different identities and experiences all of us bring to our collective identities as women. So thank you for that, and right back at you.
Thanks.
Anna, thank you very much. When you were a little boy, feeling like a little girl, or even as you grew up, can you describe what it was that felt that way? Like, the progressive mindset says that so much about gender is socially constructed.
Right.
Right? We now know that girls can be strong leaders,
right,
that men can cry and be vulnerable. It's not about who you're sexually attracted to, because that could just be being gay, which is something different. We're all trying to break the old gender stereotypes that are socially constructed by thousands of years of enforced patriarchy.
That's absolutely right.
So for you as a progressive, what felt like a girl that felt biological, if that's the right word, or otherwise couldn't be denied?
You know, I think that's a really interesting question. I think the first thing is that transgender people, for instance, transgender women like me, have always been girls and women. We just weren't seen as that. Gay and lesbian people weren't straight before they came out as gay. And so for me, you know, the way I look at it is I've always been a girl. It's something I've always known about myself. It just wasn't seen and affirmed by society for the first 21 years of my life, in the same way that for far too many gay and lesbian people, their sexual orientation is not seen and affirmed by society.
But what were the elements of that essential girlness?
And I think what's important is that, you know, there are certain sort of socially constructed cues and experiences that we associate with different genders, that in participating in those things, the pain for me started to go away. But it wasn't, oh, I like dresses, so I must be a girl. Oh, I like these things that are traditionally associated with being with femininity, and so I must be a girl. Because none of those things are inextricably linked with womanhood.
Right.
And so for me, it wasn't this sort of intellectual experience of I like dresses, so A equals, or you know, if I like dresses, then I'm a woman.
Mm-hmm.
It's this more visceral knowledge of, one, that pain, and knowing when the pain goes away. The pain goes away when people acknowledge through language, through interactions, the affirmation of my gender identity. And, you know, I think the point you raised, though, about the social construction of gender is a really important one, and it's one I had a lot of conversations with my father about, who's a progressive like me, and who said, you know, I thought gender was a social construct. And my response to him is that gender, to me, is a lot like language. Language is a social construct. The words we use, the grammar we use, all of the different elements of language are a social construct. But they still express very real feelings. Happiness is a real feeling, for instance, but the word happiness is a social construct. And just like with gender, where there are an infinite number of ways of expressing that deeply held gender identity, there's no stereotype that everyone should or have to abide by. In the same way, that feeling of happiness or that feeling of sadness, there are nearly an infinite number of different ways, both in language and cues and nonverbals, to express those very real feelings. So something can be a social construct in the way we express and the way we interact with the world, but that doesn't change that there can be a true, deeply held element of one's identity within it.
Beautifully said. It's almost like you can't necessarily put it into words, but you know it when you experience it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's like I said, I think an example a number of people use is if you're right-handed and you start writing with your left hand and someone says, how does that feel? And you're like, well, it doesn't feel right. And how do you know? Well, it just doesn't feel right. At a certain point, it becomes impossible to define pain or define that experience beyond just the basic of it doesn't feel right. It hurts. And that's what it was like for me.
Lynn in Suffolk County, you're on WNYC. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
First of all, just thank you for speaking out on this. My granddaughter is about to be 10, and by the time she was 4 years old, she could tell us that, I know I look like a boy, but my spirit is a girl. When we would play house, she wanted to be the mom. If we played Star Wars, she wanted to be Princess Leia. It was just always so clear to her. Luckily, there has been zero pushback from the family or the school. She goes to school in a dress. She's just a girl.
Right.
There has been no problem. I, as her grandmother, live in fear that a problem will crop up for her. But, you know, people face challenges all the time. And so hopefully things continue to go as smoothly for her as they are, because she's just a little girl and she is very, very happy.
Well, that brings so much joy to my heart. And I want to start by saying thank you for loving your grandchild. And I think you and it's clear your family have provided her with one of the single most important things in this journey, which is a supportive social network and a supportive family. That is so important. And I think in my life, one of the things that brings me more joy than anything else is getting to meet young transgender kids, young people who are doing what once seemed so impossible to me 20 years ago when I was growing up. They are both living their truth and dreaming big dreams all at the same time. And like you said, that's a byproduct of social change. It's a byproduct of advancements in science and research. It's a byproduct of families welcoming a transgender loved one with broad smiles and open arms. And so I just want to thank you for helping to transform impossibility into reality today.
Lynn, was it easier for you as a grandmother than it was for the parents?
No, it's very interesting. At first, Mia, I think she did what a lot of trans kids do. She wore dresses at home and went to school in boys' clothes. And it was her mother. One day, Mia came and said, I'm going to school in a dress tomorrow. I think she was 6 at the time. And her mother said, okay. And my daughter-in-law said, when I let her off for school, I said to myself, well, good luck. But kids just accepted her for, maybe it was because she was so young. But, you know, she went to school in a dress and has never looked back. And in our family, we're lucky we have great-grandparents. Everybody is just on. It's just who she is.
Yes.
My son always says, when he'll tell people his daughter is transgender, that they'll give him a lot of props. Oh, you're so wonderful and accepting. And he says, isn't that sad? You should not be wonderful if you love your child. Mm. You should be criticized if you don't. Mm.
Lynn, thank you so much.
Amen. Thank you, Lynn.
Angie in Somerset County, you're on WNYC. Hi, Angie.
Hi, Brian. Hi, Sarah. I wanted to get back to your comment, Brian, earlier, that you wondered if about Sarah said his parents, particularly his mother, thought about losing a child. And that's a very real kind of experience for a parent who has a transgender child. I have one. And I think that my son probably came out, you were talking about Christmas of 2011, Sarah, and I think my son came out Thanksgiving of 2011. So there are so many expectations you don't realize you have of a child when they are one gender versus the other. I remember thinking, oh my God, my kid is never going to walk down the aisle in a white dress. And that process, giving myself the time to process that, but always accepting that this took courage for him to tell us. He deliberately wanted us to know who he really was. And in spite of all that fear and that expectation, it was our role as parents to love this person who we had helped create. So, Sarah, keep talking about it. I hope that you're right. I hope that we are, in terms of rights, in 2005 instead of the 90s. I fear the current political climate a lot. This is probably the one thing that's motivated me to be most politically active, is that I'm concerned about my child's rights as an American citizen. But thanks for having the show, because it is so hugely important.
Angie, thank you so much.
Thank you, Angie.
Bye-bye.
Turned into a little bit of a therapy session for parents and grandparents.
Well,
right?
and Lynn was absolutely right that you know, my goal is to get to a place where we don't have to thank parents for loving their child, but sadly that's not the case. So I, you know, Angie, thank you for loving your child, and thank you for creating the space for your child to live their life more wholly. And I think, you know, one of the things that was so clear to me when I came out, both in watching my parents mourn my loss, but also in stepping out into this world as my authentic self, was just how much we interact with gender in our day-to-day lives, just how much our hopes and our dreams and our visions for the future are inextricably linked in so many ways with our perceptions of a person's gender identity. And then to your point about the political climate, I think it is so important for folks who aren't transgender, who maybe don't have a marginalized identity, to understand just how scared people are in this country, and to understand that after the election and for the last year and a half, far too many people have had to wonder whether the heart of this country is big enough to love them too. And that is something that no one should have to experience. But I will also say that I have seen, and this is one of the reasons why I think we're in 2005 on this issue and not in the 90s, is that every single time a politician comes for us, whether it's Pat McCrory in North Carolina or Donald Trump with the military and trans students, it creates a national dialogue that only serves to open hearts, change minds, and ends up sowing the seeds of the destruction of the politics of hate that those politicians are employing. And so there is an alliance of allies, a growing alliance standing with us in this fight, and every single time they come for us, it only makes us stronger.
And it's so great that parents and grandparents have been calling in and sharing their stories of acceptance, because I think it not necessarily opens the hearts. I think parents' hearts are open to their kids almost automatically in almost every case, but kind of paves the way for some parents who might be struggling with it right now to take that next step.
It models the right behavior, because acceptance provides a standard while rejection provides an excuse.
Last question. We had a caller who couldn't hold on, who's a school counselor, I think a guidance counselor in elementary school, and wanted some advice from you on how to deal with kids at the school level who may be transgender or expressing transgender expressions of some kind or another at a relatively early childhood level.
Yeah. I think two things. One is take your cues from that child, from that young person. I think people think that people are too young to know their gender identity. But when it comes to non-transgender kids, you know, we never go, oh, you're only five, you can't know that you're a boy. So take your cues from that child. Do what that child requests. You know, oftentimes that school might be the safest place for that child. And allowing that young person to be respected and affirmed in that school can not only be the right thing to do, it can be life-saving for that child. And we know that when transgender young people are allowed to live authentically and be seen as themselves, it doesn't just allow them to be whole, it actually allows them to pursue their dreams and thrive academically.
Sarah McBride's book, with a foreword by Joe Biden, is called Tomorrow Will Be Different: Love, Loss, and the Fight for Trans Equality. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and with us now is New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof. He has performed a great service by not letting the genocide of the Rohingya people taking place in Myanmar completely fall off the media's radar screen. You know, we can get so consumed with everything that feels so urgent close to home, school shootings, jobs, everything about Trump, that we can lose sight of the worst things in the world that may be happening in places we consider remote. So Nick's article in the Sunday Review is called I Saw a Genocide in Slow Motion. It's reporting from his fourth trip to Myanmar in 4 years to document this horror. We'll talk about this and touch a bit on some of his other recent columns, like his proposal for a better way to fight gun violence, and maybe touch on China, a long interest of Nicholas Kristof's, where Xi Jinping seems to be grabbing for the title president for life. But Nick, thanks for coming on again. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you. Good to be with you, Brian.
So for people not engaged in this story yet, remind us of the big picture. Who are the Rohingya, and why have you gone on four reporting trips to Myanmar in 4 years?
So they're an ethnic and religious minority in the western part of Myanmar. And they've always been marginalized, but since democracy has more or less come to Myanmar, they've been particularly targeted, partly because democratic politicians realize that they can make political hay from denouncing them. And also, as the internet has come more to Myanmar, then Facebook and other apps have been used to vilify the Rohingya. And so there have been periodic pogroms in the past against them, but the worst began late last August when there was a incipient rebellion by a small Rohingya armed group, and the army just responded with a brutal scorched earth counterinsurgency, burning villages, raping women, killing boys, men, throwing babies into bonfires, and so about 700,000 Rohingya fled across the border into Bangladesh, but there were maybe 500,000 or so left behind, and the Myanmar government has denied humanitarian access to help those people. They've been confined to their villages or to a concentration camp. And so the purpose of my trip was to try to figure out what is happening to some of those left behind.
Genocide is such a grave thing. Maybe it's like the heaviest thing in human interaction of any kind. You used to call this situation ethnic cleansing, which is horrific enough. Why do you now use the G word?
So, I think we shouldn't lightly use the word genocide, but when you come across villages that have been systematically destroyed by the army, by people carrying out orders, by, you know, seeing just about every male in the village shot dead, the women systematically gang raped, the babies having their throats cut or tossed into bonfires, and then when you have a government policy of denying humanitarian access, denying medical care to the survivors, in some cases denying food assistance, that's kind of the standard genocide approach that governments have used toward a besieged minority. And the hard part legally in determining a genocide is to determine intent. And so that will have to wait some kind of a legal proceeding. But I'd say many human rights observers in the last couple of years, and me too, we've increasingly come to feel that this is probably a genocide that is unfolding before us.
So you describe, and you just referred to, a genocide in slow motion. It's about denying food and medical care more than killing with machetes and guns?
Yeah, the killing with machetes and guns, for the most part, stopped after the sudden spree of violence last August and September. And so since then, the Rohingya have been confined to their villages, and for the most part, they're not being mowed down with machine guns right now. But aid groups are not allowed to bring them assistance, and they're not allowed to get any medical care. So one of the people that I visited was a woman, Sonowara, and the day before I visited, she had delivered twins. It was her first pregnancy. She's 18. She desperately needed some kind of medical help. And without being able to access that, she managed to survive, but both of her twins died. And And nearby, I spoke to a husband who had just lost his wife in childbirth as well. And this is, you know, completely unnecessary. There are aid groups that are willing to provide assistance. This is just gratuitous cruelty to try to make life unbearable for the Rohingya and encourage them to flee the country. And this is happening under a Nobel Peace Prize winner, of course, Aung San Suu Kyi, presiding over the country.
And I want to get to Aung San Suu Kyi in just a second. I want to invite our listeners in first. Anything you want to say or ask of Nicholas Kristof about the genocide of the Rohingya or any of his other recent columns, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And you name in your piece Myanmar's leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, who once won the Nobel Peace Prize for running a nonviolent democracy movement when the country was under authoritarian rule. Now she presides over genocide. Did she change, or was the world wrong about her all along?
My guess is that both are true. I think she was probably always more of a Burman nationalist than of somebody who was really supporting human rights of all peoples. But I think in addition that she evolved into becoming a politician, and she realized that if she had anything nice to say about the Rohingya, that would cost her party votes. And so she became an opportunist. And right now in Myanmar, to show is just lethal politically in Myanmar.
Is Aung San Suu Kyi presently a democratically elected leader? Is a hard lesson here that democratically elected governments and genocidal governments are not mutually exclusive?
So she is barred from holding from actually leading the government as such by the military, but her party won the elections, and so she is the most powerful figure in the government. She does not control the army. They have their own domain, but she dominates the government. And she has been complicit in the army's slaughter, the army's rampages through the Rohingya areas. She has defended it. She's blamed aid groups. When a Rohingya woman came forward to talk about having been raped by the army, she denounced it as fake rape. And right now there are two Reuters reporters who were imprisoned for reporting on these massacres. And her government has prosecuted them, and now they're facing up to 14 years in prison. So it's not exactly as if Suu Kyi herself is ordering these massacres, but she is playing a central role, not only in defending them, but actually in denying humanitarian access and continuing these policies.
You bring up the Reuters journalists who are now in prison for trying to report the story, and they keep journalists out, or they try to. So how much of your trip was an act of stealth?
It was entirely stealth. I could not get a journalist visa into Myanmar because I've written about these issues. The Myanmar government is not my biggest fan. But as it happened, I was leading a New York Times tour to Myanmar. My segment was ending in Myanmar, so that got me a tourist visa, and then I left the tour and just tried to stay below the radar and went to the Rohingya areas and tried to avoid the checkpoints. I had a car with tinted windows. I at one point took a boat to get around various checkpoints. And some local people were quite helpful in telling me what paths to take to avoid those checkpoints.
Diana in New Rochelle, you're on WNYC with New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof. Hi.
Hi. I read your column on Sunday, Nicholas, and was so horrified. I know you report on these, and I think that Aung San Suu Kyi should be tried as a war criminal. and her Nobel Peace Prize should be rescinded. She is just as culpable as the army that is going in and doing these atrocities, and it is a genocide. And you point out that they're not allowing aid workers in. What can we do? What kind of pressure can we bring to bear, and who should we contact to do this, to bring some pressure on their government and to remove her and affect some sort of change? And do you and your wife still have some sort of an organization that we can work with?
So thanks for your queries and great question on the on where we find pressure. And I should say that my wife and I are, we're still writing books, this kind of thing, but we try to refer people to other organizations rather than to have our own organization. And so human rights groups are doing a fantastic job trying to call attention to what is going on. There is one that is focused on Myanmar that is called Fortify Rights, but Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International also doing just a superb job on this. One of the problems is that we in the U.S. really don't have much leverage over Myanmar, partly because China protects it in the U.N. Security Council. But I do think that, we have some influence and that we can raise the cost of these kinds of atrocities with naming and shaming. And Secretary of State Tillerson has indeed referred to ethnic cleansing, which was great. The White House has been completely silent on this. And I think that maybe the best leverage we would have is targeted sanctions on Myanmar leaders. I would not favor general sanctions on all of Myanmar, because then ordinary citizens, many of them poor, would pay the price. But targeted sanctions on the leaders, I think, maybe the best approach, and that was the approach that ultimately got the military to back down and allow the recent elections. There is legislation in both the House and the Senate that would apply targeted sanctions. In the Senate, it's backed by Senators Durbin and McCain. It's bipartisan. It got through the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And for reasons that I don't fully understand, Mitch McConnell is currently holding it up. So I would encourage people to, to ask their House member or their senators to back the legislation for targeted sanctions on Myanmar.
We'll continue in a minute with New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof, Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof, just back from his fourth reporting trip in 4 years to Myanmar to document the ethnic cleansing, he used to call it. Now he uses the word genocide against the Rohingya people there. We'll also get into some of Nick's other recent columns on other things, but let's take another phone call on this. Fitzcarl in Miami, you're on WNYC with Nicholas Kristof. Hi there.
Hi, Brian. Sad to hear all of this. Mr. Kristof, I have a question for you. Does Buddhism, the belief of, Myanmar, most of the people, not play any factor in checking people's, what has been done to the Rohingya people at all? Like, does Buddhism at all count? Like, what's going on? It's supposed to be a Buddhist country, right?
And if Buddhism, if we stereotype religions in various ways, we stereotype Buddhism as being so Zen, with all the implications of that. Is this a Buddhist genocide against Muslims?
It would be a little unfair to blame this on Buddha. We certainly don't, we tend not to think, as you say, about, radical Buddhists or Buddhist extremists. But it is true that the population is overwhelmingly Buddhist, and that there really is a religious dimension where you have Buddhists oppressing Muslims. I talked to a number of Buddhist priests about this, and they are some of the people who are particularly gung-ho in this ethnic cleansing or in this genocide. I should say that there are many Buddhists who are aghast. The Dalai Lama has spoken very forcefully about the slaughter of the Rohingya and has condemned what is going on, but his sect of Buddhism is not the sect that is practiced in Myanmar, and so he does not have much influence there.
You talked about being disappointed in Aung San Suu Kyi. I'm curious to get your take, since we've talked before about your interest in China, where you've spent time, on how disappointed you are in Xi Jinping. I happened to be in China around the end of 2012, around the time he was being elevated to leader, and was on a tour for journalists, and I got to speak to academics and business people and others who were kind of optimistic. And I looked back and saw your column from 5 years ago, and you wrote, "Here's my prediction about China. The new paramount leader, Xi Jinping, will spearhead a resurgence of economic reform and probably some political easing as well. Liu Xiaobo, Nobel Peace Prize winning writer, will be released from prison. So I'm not citing this to embarrass you. Seems like a lot of
did not age particularly well.
A lot of people were wrong about Xi Jinping. So I'm curious what you think happened that turned out that he turned out to be such a hardliner and is now making himself president for life.
Yeah, and I mean the worst part about it is not just his grasping for the presidency for life and effectively becoming an emperor. Really, the worst part of it is that he has presided over this really harsh crackdown over the internet, over the legal system, lawyers and judges, over dissent, over journalism, over what websites are available. And so previously, former Chinese leaders like Deng Xiaoping or Jiang Zemin, I think, had a vision in which they would gradually, over time, become more like Singapore or Taiwan, that the Communist Party would remain dominant, but that they might use elections to get a little more legitimacy, elections among favored candidates. And that now seems to have completely disappeared. And Xi Jinping is a strong man, and he doesn't want to allow any free space. I must say, though, that having covered the arrival of human rights and democracy in so much of the rest of Asia, from South Korea to Indonesia to Mongolia, Taiwan, I think that Xi Jinping is going against larger forces of history, and that when you make people richer, when you make people more educated, when you give them choices about what kinds of tea and coffee they eat, then eventually there is pressure for a more open political system. But it can be quite a wait.
Not a straight line. Let me touch on a few of your other recent columns. On guns after Parkland, you wrote a column, How to Reduce Shootings. And in part of that, you wrote, the liberal approach is ineffective. Use a public health approach instead. What's the difference?
So, I mean, one of the problems has been that when liberals like myself propose different measures, then the upshot tends not to be new legislation, but rather millions of new guns sold by gun owners who are manipulated to think that people are going to come and get their guns. And we do have really an excellent example of a dangerous product that we have figured out how to incorporate in our lives and make a lot safer, and that is cars. And so, I mean, whenever I write about guns, I hear from gun owners who say, nobody takes away our cars, even though they kill about as many people as guns do. No, but we really try very hard to make cars safer. And since 1921, we've reduced the auto fatality rate per 100 million miles driven by 95%. And, we've done that by regulating who can drive a car, by requiring insurance, by designing better roads, by having better bumpers, by airbags, seatbelts, a million things. And no one thing was transformative, but we really tried to take this public health approach and rely on evidence. And in the area of guns, we're even denied the evidence because the NRA has blocked research into gun violence. And so we lose one American every 15 minutes from gun violence. We don't really have nearly as good a sense as we should about how to reduce that toll.
Another of your recent columns was in quiz form called What Poisons Are in Your Body? And there were some very common items on that list that might surprise people, like cash register receipts, liquid soap, vinyl shower curtains, and Colgate Total toothpaste, also canned food. Briefly, why did you single out one brand of toothpaste?
Well, that's actually the one brand that still has a something called triclosan in it that is a endocrine-disrupting chemical. Endocrine disruptors are a kind of chemical that mimic hormones and that often confuse the body into treating them as hormones, and they seem particularly problematic for that reason. Canada and Europe have regulated them much more effectively. The U.S. has deferred to industry, and the result is that industry can spew endocrine disruptors among us, and we don't really even know where those chemicals are.
And cash register receipts, you know, for people working at the register, this is probably where our concern should go, right? Like, we remember that the original smoking in restaurants ban under Mayor Bloomberg was a workplace safety measure. It wasn't so much for customers who could go to other places. It was because the workers have no choice but to work, you know, in one place or another. So do customers have enough exposure to register receipts to be concerned too?
Well, you know, one of the problems is we don't really know, because most of these chemicals haven't been rigorously tested. And so there, you know, there'll be some animal tests, there'll be some human tests, there'll be red flags that arise. And then what typically happens is the chemical companies will take out the old product that alarms people, and then we'll substitute a new chemical that is a cousin of the problematic one, but that is completely untested. There's this mistaken view that chemicals in these products around us must have undergone safety testing, and in fact, you know, that's not true at all. The vast majority of them haven't, and so we don't really have a very good sense of what the risks are, at what quantity, and that. Creates a real problem for all of us as consumers.
We just have one. Go ahead. Did you want to say something?
One toxicologist was telling me that the real problem now is that you kind of have to be a PhD toxicologist to figure out how to reduce your exposures and how to make yourself safer. And you know, that's not what consumers should have to do.
New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof. His Sunday Review piece on the genocide taking place in Myanmar against the Rohingya people and what can be done about it is very much worth reading. His fourth trip in 4 years to Myanmar to keep covering this story, which is so easy for it to fall off our radar screens with other things closer to home, always feeling so urgent. Thank you very much for coming on and talking about that and other things.
Great to be with you, Brian.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. Hope you're all digging out okay from yesterday's storm. I know some of you lost power last night, some of you for a second time in a week. And the snow totals are so disparate. Have you heard this? Just 3 inches in Central Park, and no more than 6 that I've seen reported for Nassau County, but 11 out in Stony Point. And listen to these New Jersey totals, 8 inches in Ridgewood, 15 in West Orange, and not so far from West Orange, also in Essex County, in fact, 23 in North Caldwell. And north of the city, how about 26 inches in Monroe, Putnam Valley 26, New Fairfield 26. But in the New Haven area, we have West Haven 4 inches, but North Haven 13, and hello Berkshires, 30 inches in North Adams. So I hope you have good snowplows or good neighbors. All right, so there's a little snow news. We'll begin today by taking President Trump's steel and aluminum tariffs seriously as a policy proposal. As you know, on this show, when the president uses racism or other forms of hate to promote himself politically, We don't treat it as an issue with two sides. When he blatantly lies or shows corrupt moral character, we just call it out. And yes, that's almost every day. And when he reveals that he doesn't even understand the policies that he spouts and is just spouting them for reality TV purposes, we label it as such. And that last one might apply to tariffs too, especially when the president announces them in what seems like an impulsive outburst, taking his own White House officials largely by surprise. But when there is an actual substantive policy proposal that might actually become law or U.S. government policy and affect a lot of people, we'll still dive in with multiple points of view. So the 10% tariff on aluminum imports, 25% on steel is being denounced by most economists. And you know about it apparently being the last straw for Trump's chief economics advisor, Carrie Cohn, who's announced his resignation. But there may be more Democrats than Republicans who find some merit in targeted tariffs. And the AFL-CIO has endorsed the idea. So to begin the program today, we will get two views, beginning first with a rising star in the Democratic Party, Congressman Tim Ryan, who represents the Akron and Youngstown area of Ohio, obviously hard hit by the decline of the American steel industry. Ryan, as you may know, also challenged Nancy Pelosi after the last elections for the position of House Minority Leader. He has said in general, after Trump carried his state, that the Democratic Party alienates a lot of voters it doesn't have to alienate while still sticking to its values, could still stick to its values without alienating so many people, but that its current state will make it harder than it has to be to win back control of the House this year. His name has even been mentioned as a possible 2020 Democratic presidential primary candidate, and we'll get to that a little bit too. Congressman Ryan, we so appreciate you coming on with us. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you so much. You know, being an Ohio guy, it's fun to hear someone else talk about all the snow that you got. So
yeah, right.
I hope everybody's okay.
That's right. Well, you know, growing up in New York and living in Albany for 8 years, and then I went to grad school at Ohio State. And
oh my goodness.
I never had so much snow anywhere I was in the year that I was in Columbus. So I know how you get.
It's all part of our charm.
Can you give our listeners here in New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut first a sense of your district in Ohio and what has happened to steel or aluminum jobs over the years? Is that a good place to start?
Sure. Yeah, my district is in Northeast Ohio. I represent the cities of Akron and the city of Youngstown and points in between. I'm halfway between Cleveland and Pittsburgh, so heart of the old steel belt, and you know the peak of the Industrial Revolution that's obviously been hard hit in the last 30 to 40 years through globalization and now more automation than anything, where we've seen an erosion of these manufacturing jobs happen for a long time. And a bunch of cities that are on the comeback, we have little pockets of innovations with additive manufacturing. In Akron, we're doing polymers. At Kent State University, we're doing liquid crystal and trying to spin off companies there. So we're on the comeback, but still a legacy of manufacturing, including steel and aluminum. And we've seen a lot of those integrated steel mills go by the wayside, you know, losing thousands, tens of thousands of jobs. We've seen in the U.S. aluminum companies, I think we had 12 or 13 at one point. Now we're down to just two or three major aluminum companies in the United States. So we've been kind of at the tip of the spear of that decline in the industrial age that we had here in the United States.
So you represent your district, obviously. Can you make the case, though, that targeted tariffs are not just good for your district, but for America as a whole?
Well, there's a lot of factors here, and I know, because I'm, you know, sometimes one of them, I think Trump, President Trump does not always think through what he does, and I think he knows that this issue is a issue that hits home in areas like mine, and he knows he needs to do well in Western PA, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin. But I will say, with regard to targeted tariffs, two countries that are blatantly cheating, so just to give everybody a sense, China pushing, say, steel tubing for the energy industry, their final product that lands on the shores of the United States is the same cost as an American company's raw material costs. that's the advantage that they have for a variety of different ways that they do it. They dump, you know, enormous amounts of steel on the country. They subsidize the business locally. They, for long periods of time, would manipulate their currency to make it artificially cheap so that their exports were cheaper coming in. They've done all of these different things, and it's part of a broader strategy. So I think people need to think of, especially China, in the context of what are they doing? What's their long-term strategy? It gets hard for us in the United States because we really don't have a long-term strategy. This move on tariffs is really a tactic. There's no long-term strategy, but China does have a long-term strategy. They are rebuilding their own country, moving towards renewable energy, wind, solar. They're moving the high-speed rail, battery-powered cars. They're building islands in the South China Sea, and they're putting military bases on them, projecting force. They're opening bases in Africa, and they're exploiting Africa for its natural resources to continue to feed its industrial machine. They use mercantilist tactics to increase their ability to hurt and damage other countries' economics, like they're trying to do with us, in the steel industry, and erode our manufacturing base. So people need to see it, especially from China, in this broader context of what they're trying to do. And then in addition to that, this kind of dumping, there are remedies through the General Agreements on Trade and Tariff going back to 1948. It's Article 21 that allows a country to provide a remedy to a violation of international law. And the Trade Export Act in the United States from 1962 gives us the ability, if someone's trying to intentionally hurt us and hurt our defense industrial capacity, meaning we have to be able to at least supply our own military. So, yeah, we want fair trade. Yes, we realize we're in a global economy. Yes, we have to be engaged with the world. I'm not saying build a wall and be protectionist, but what I am saying is if another country is intentionally trying to damage us and damage certain industries, there has to be remedies for us to punish them. And that's what I believe is a targeted move here that is appropriate.
Let me follow up on a couple of things you said. One, you mentioned Section 232 of the Trade Expansion Act of 1962, which is going to sound like a nerdy and wonky thing to bring up to a lot of people, but this is breaking out as a controversy. The United States has an imposed trade restrictions basically on national security grounds since 1983, something about machine tools at that time during the Reagan administration. Are you arguing that there is a legitimate national security interest in these tariffs?
I believe there is, and I believe that, you know, industry and the steel industry and the aluminum industry, they have to be commercially viable. So it's not just, you know, they hang around, like factories can hang around until we go to war, and then, you know, we're going to build a new factory and supply new airplanes, new C-130s, new F-16s, new F-18s. We have to have that industrial capabilities. And if there is some damage or harm to the broader global market, my argument is we have to do it because we have to maintain that capability. And I think the market will adjust. I don't think it's going to be as damaging as everybody says. I don't want a trade war. I don't think trade wars are good. I disagree with the president on that. I don't think Canada and Germany and some of these other countries should at all be involved in this. I think it needs to be targeted to countries like China who are directly and intentionally trying to manipulate the situation.
And even if we accept everything you said about China, which I think all those things you listed are generally accepted about China, so if we just hit China, even just that one country, for its steel dumping practices, why doesn't that start a trade war or risk starting a trade war with that country that sells Americans so many affordable goods these days, no matter what we think of their labor practices, to allow them to do that? Do they not have more leverage than we do to hurt us more than we hurt them in what might be a limited trade war against China?
Well, again, the president, in his inflammatory rhetoric, is moving away from the substantive policy issues, which I'm pretty confident he doesn't fully understand. That if we assess these tariffs, countervailing duties, anti-dumping provisions, based on a legitimate national security issue that the Department of Commerce has realized and analyzed and told us that it is the case, then that is an appropriate legal remedy for us to assess these countervailing duties and anti-dumping provisions. Now, if China would then retaliate, that would actually be the beginning of the trade war. If they said, well, we're going to put, you know, we're going to increase the cost or prevent whatever you're shipping here, we're going to increase the tariffs on those products.
So how confident
for
are you?
National security grounds, then that would be the beginning of the trade war.
So that's where blame would lie. But why are you confident that imposing the steel and aluminum tariffs wouldn't cause them to do that? Because they don't really care if they're blamed.
Well, again, so my position is that the national security implications in the short, mid, and long term for the United States are the biggest priority here for us. And we need to make sure that we maintain those capabilities. I mean, we cannot rely on Vladimir Putin for Russian steel. I mean, that's not the position we want to be in. We have to maintain a defense industrial base. And that is, to me, the highest order for all of us. Now, let me be very, very clear here. I don't think that this assessment, this countervailing duty position and what the president's doing here is going to have a huge effect on job growth. It's not going to bring the steel industry back. You know, I'm not a Luddite. I don't think that, you know, we're going to build walls and think that, you know, we can retreat back to the United States. We have got a million other things that we need to do to grow the economy, to get investment into the industrial Midwest, to, you know, lay broadband, move to renewable energy, all of the things. I did a bus tour 2 weeks ago, and I brought 12 Silicon Valley venture capitalists to Youngstown, Akron, Flint, Detroit, and South Bend, Indiana, because we need private investment pushing technologies, the latest and greatest, into these areas that have fallen behind and have not participated in globalization. So I don't want to give anybody the sense that I think, boy, if we put these tariffs on, the Youngstown Sheet and Tube's going to come back and hire 20,000 people. That's just not going to be the case.
Right.
But I do think it's an appropriate remedy given the fact that China's intentionally doing this.
And have you run any of the numbers on jobs overall? Because one of the most common critiques I've heard is that if we raise the price of imported steel, we'll get more steel made here, but not that many more jobs because of modern robotics in the steel industry. And the tariffs will actually cost us jobs in industries that use steel to make things, like the auto industry. Our guest later in the hour, economics professor Joseph Francois from Bern, Switzerland, argues it would create about 33,000 U.S. jobs, but cost 180,000. Do you have different numbers?
No, I mean, I think that there will be a reaction in the market. Now, I do think there's still global competition, so it's not like, you know, prices are going to go through the roof all of a sudden. There are still, you know, we still get steel from Russia, from Brazil. You know, we get it from South Korea. We get it from Japan. So there's still a global market for steel. So I don't think that it's going to have that huge of an impact. But what I'm arguing here is that losing that last bastion of our defense industrial base is not worth it. And so you may see some job growth and you may see some shifts in job production in other areas. That very well may happen. But at the end of the day, I think we have to protect the integrity of our defense industrial base. So I'm not blind to that this is going to have damage. I'm just saying that in the long term, and look, we had a $1 billion steel mill expansion in Youngstown that really only produced about 400 or 500 additional jobs. So this industry, like coal and others, is being extremely automated, which is why I'm saying we've got to get Silicon Valley into the Midwest. We've got to get investment into the Midwest. We've got to lay broadband in the Midwest. We've got to do a new energy grid. We've got to push new renewable energy sectors of the economy that are growing by 20-25% a year into coal country, into steel country. So this isn't a holistic economic growth plan. This is about protecting our defense industrial base. And quite frankly, it doesn't go far enough because we're also losing in different areas in the metals capability, which we need for a lot of the sophisticated machinery that we use in our defense industrial base as well.
We have a few minutes left with Congressman Tim Ryan, Democrat from Ohio. Can I ask briefly, and I think you have to go and vote in a couple of minutes, but can I ask what you're thinking these days in terms of how the Democratic Party looks nationally a year and a little into Trump and your challenge to Nancy Pelosi for minority leader?
Well, I think we're going to see here in a few days. We have a special election in Western PA for an open congressional seat. Connor Lamb is running in that seat. And the polls have him pretty much neck and neck, maybe a little up a point or two. That election is on Tuesday, so we'll have a little canary in the coal mine, so to speak, with the Connor Lamb. I think he's doing a very good job of kind of talking about bringing in some new leadership. I think he's doing a very good job focusing on economics, those kind of things that unite us. He's talking about pensions and Social Security and Medicare and health care and jobs and wages, which really is an issue I think we've kind of lost on in so many different ways. Mm-hmm. And so I think if he wins, that will really be the model moving into the fall for other Democrats, focusing on the economic issues, those things that unite us and those things that people are talking about in places like Youngstown, Ohio. They're still struggling to make ends meet. They're still living paycheck to paycheck. And we have got to speak to their aspiration. I'll just give you one quick example. We talk a lot about raising the minimum wage, you know, which I'm for and a lot of people are for, $12, $13, $15, mm-hmm. fight for 15.
Right.
Here's the issue. People in places like Youngstown, upstate New York, and other places, at one point they were making $40 an hour. Now they're making $15. So if our sole focus is on $15 an hour, we are not speaking to the aspiration of that family, of that worker. And so sometimes we get caught up so focused on an issue like that that we're missing the aspiration. And I want to see Democrats say, we need to be talking about $30 or $40 an hour. Yeah, it's not going to be the old steel job from 40 years ago, but it may be computer coding. It may be laying broadband. It may be working to lay a new energy grid, a smart grid, or moving into the renewable energy sector. But we've got to speak to that aspiration. And if we don't, you know, guys like Trump come in and people default their vote back to nostalgia, back to coal mines and steel mills, which isn't even within the realm of reality, as we just talked about.
So last question for now, and I hope we can continue this on another occasion. And I really appreciate you coming on and talking to, you know, the New York area and lower New England as a Ohio congressman. Not everybody thinks the Democrats can win back many white working class, mostly male voters without downplaying the issues of women and immigrants and African Americans to the point where the party would not be sticking to its principles or risk creating voter apathy in too much of its current base. You think the party can walk that line more successfully than it is, I know. Can you lay out for our listeners in, you know, our diverse area of the country here how you think it can do that?
The systems are broken all over the country, and we need a political party that can help us rebuild new systems. And so whether you're talking about an economic system, as we just did, that is not producing the kind of high-wage jobs and security that we need, or you're talking about a criminal justice system that's broken, that's putting African-American kids, you know, really in a tough situation with, you know, getting busted at a young age for marijuana and that ruining your whole life and your ability to go get a job. That's a broken criminal justice system that in many ways is racist. The immigration system, clearly we see every single day how broken it is, whether you're talking about comprehensive immigration reform or the Dreamers, the inability for this system to be able to bring people in safely to our country and assimilate them in our country. That's a broken system. We have a broken food system where you have half the country now has diabetes or pre-diabetes, and we subsidize crops that lead to very highly processed food that has created a really sick country that we have right now. That system is broken. Our agricultural system is broken. We have algae blooms in the Great Lakes and dead zones at the mouth of the Mississippi River. We have climate change is a huge issue. So all of these systems are broken. And the Democratic Party, my estimation, has got to be the party that is going to bring these systems and the government into the 21st century and start making the government work for the people. And whether you're a black kid in New York City or you're a Latino out in Los Angeles or you're, you know, a white working class person in the Midwest, our party needs to be for everybody. A woman who lives in a state that where there's being a tax on women's rights, or if you're a teacher in West Virginia. I mean, we have got to stop saying we can only be for one segment at a time. This party is a party of America. This is the party of the great society. We can walk and chew gum at the same time, and we have to. That's how we're going to reclaim our country, not this division that we get from the President of the United States, where he intentionally tries to divide us. We've got to say we are joining hands, locking arms, and we're going at this together, and we're going to fix the economic system. We're going to fix the criminal justice system. We're going to fix these attacks on women's rights. We're going to fix the immigration. But we have to do it together. This is my main point. We can't achieve any of those goals if we are divided. If we let the president and the Republicans and the Koch brothers divide us, nobody's going to get anything. We're not going to get criminal justice reform. We thought maybe that was going to be the big issue that the Republicans and Democrats are going to work on together. That ain't happening. Immigration reform. We can't even get 900,000 Dreamers to feel safe in the country. We have got to come together, white, black, brown, male, female, gay, straight, together, arm in arm, and say, this is the Democratic Party of 2018, 19, 20, and we're going to fix all of this stuff because we're going to have a massive coalition, including a generation of young kids who want to get assault weapons off of the streets. We're going to solve these problems, but we got to do it together and recognize that we can't achieve this stuff alone. That, to me, is the future of the Democratic Party.
Congressman Tim Ryan, Democrat from Ohio, thank you so much for giving us some time this morning. We really appreciate it.
Take care. Thanks for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Interesting conversation with Congressman Ryan there, whose name, if you haven't heard it before, you're likely to hear in the future. He did challenge Nancy Pelosi for the position of House Minority Leader, Democratic Leader, last year. If the Democrats win the House, we'll see if he challenges her for Speaker next year or even tries to run for president in 2020, as people are speculating he might, as a representative of that approach that he was just articulating to growing and regrowing the Democratic Party in the U.S. We'll continue that conversation with other guests as we go. But right now, another view on the president's steel and aluminum tariffs, in particular from Joseph Francois, managing director and professor of economics at the World Trade Institute in Bern, Switzerland. He also contributed to a new report on tariffs that we will talk about here. Professor Francois, thank you very much for coming on. Hello from New York.
Hello. Thank you for having me on.
I don't know how much of Congressman Ryan you were able to hear on tariffs there, but if so, where would you like to start to respond?
Okay, so I heard the whole thing. And I actually find that I agree with where Congressman Ryan is in terms of what he's worried about and what his objectives are. I'm just not convinced that the current proposed remedies actually get us there. But I think he's right in terms of worrying about economically distressed communities. I think we need to think about how we move the old economy into the old manufacturing heartland. The thing is, wage stagnation goes back to the 70s. We've been going through an industrial revolution, basically restructuring, getting rid of more labor-intensive production, and we haven't really dealt with the consequences of it. And this is something that's been happening for decades. I think he's entirely right about that. I don't see that putting duties on China for steel doesn't really. I don't see that gets us there. Partly just it's boring, but the numbers, right? So about 90% of Chinese steel exports to the U.S. are already covered by dumping duties or countervailing duties, which is for the non-technical people in the audience, these are tariffs because the government has found that trade is dumped or is subsidized. China is a very small share directly of U.S. steel imports. So again, if you do want to keep China, or you want to help the steel industry, unless you are going after our friends, Mexico and Canada and Germany and so on, you don't get much directly with these duties. And it is there is the question of what happens to downstream industries that consume steel, construction, washing machines, things of that sort.
And Congressman Ryan didn't even seem to question your premise, because I read him your numbers from your report, 180,000 lost jobs for about 33,000 created if we go ahead with widespread steel and aluminum tariffs. And he didn't even really question it. He seemed to say that it's more important for the premise that a country like China can't just get away with dumping below cost to warp the global market without some kind of retaliation, and B, it's so important for our potential for making war if we need it for national security purposes that we have to be a country that makes steel to be able to make our own weapons, so it's not in the hands of Xi Jinping or Vladimir Putin or even Canada or Germany, that we have enough steel to do that. That, did you hear it that way? He wasn't actually arguing with your jobs numbers.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I think it's good to go back and look at the last time we were here, which was in the Bush administration. Okay, so early 2000s, we went through roughly the same thing. Again, duties were put in place. They stayed in for a few years, and then they were brought down. Since then, so U.S. steel production is actually up about 8% since the start of 2000. But it's the jobs that are gone, right? So the way that we make steel has changed dramatically, right? So we've lost about 40% of steel jobs while making the same amount of steel. So it's not really that imports have sort of forced the amount of production down. It's just that, you know, we don't have the kind of steel jobs we used to have. And I agree with the congressman when he said that, you know, this won't bring the old type steel jobs back. It may be good for jobs for robots, and it may shift certain types of production more into the U.S., but it will hurt downstream. And it doesn't address the broader problem, which is across manufacturing overall, output is up while jobs fall. Okay, and so it's a problem not just for steel. It's a problem for the old manufacturing heartland in terms of the change in how we make things. And this doesn't address that. It's sort of it's a distraction in a way.
And do you think, I heard today with the president planning now maybe to exempt Canada and Mexico for, I think he says, national security reasons, also maybe because we have obligations under the NAFTA treaty, I'm not sure. But I heard an alternative theory of why it doesn't matter if we exempt Canada or Mexico, because or why that would be, you know, damaging to the president's project here, because if we exempt Canada, a lot of Chinese and other foreign steel will basically get laundered through Canada. They'll ship it to Canada, and then they'll sell it, whoever the intervening party is, will sell it as Canadian steel to the United States. And so if we exempt Canada, we basically, you know, neuter the project that the president is trying to go after. How much do you agree with that?
No, I mean, there's something called rules of origin. So when you have a free trade agreement, there are provisions to determine where something was made. And so, you know, it's what you're describing, if they did it successfully, is a criminal enterprise. But, you know, it's customs fraud. You have to indicate where something came from. I think the bigger worry is that China depresses steel globally. It doesn't ship much directly to the U.S. But Korea, for example, buys Chinese steel. That means they can sell washing machines cheaper in the U.S. The trading system doesn't deal well with the fact that value chains are now global, right, that you're sourcing stuff from various places. And so U.S. producers using U.S. steel are at a disadvantage with Koreans because the Chinese buy Korean steel, for example.
Yeah.
But you know, we recently did a trade remedy on washing machines too. The Chinese steel is covered by dumping. It's covered by countervailing duties. The products where they do end up pushing down the cost of downstream steel products, I think we need to address that. And there was anyway an effort to address the overcapacity through the OECD and through the G20. And I'm not sure if this is going to help that process move forward. But the goal was to share data, to work on getting capacity down. The Chinese were sort of grudgingly cooperating on that. And this kind of pulls the rug out from that process.
Do you think there would be a trade war? Do you think China would start raising the prices of all kinds of other things? I raised that scenario with Congressman Ryan, and he said, well, yeah, then we wouldn't be starting the trade war. They would be starting the trade war. This is just setting fair rules when they're unfairly dumping steel. But I'm not sure if it matters who we say started the trade war as opposed to who did something legitimate. If China decides to retaliate against steel tariffs by raising the price, you know, of all kinds of things that the U.S. would want to import there, and we're trying to have an export economy, you know, not to mention how they might raise the price on all kinds of American goods that American consumers buy at reasonable prices because they come from China, no matter what we think of their labor policies, that there's going to be a bigger reaction, therefore bigger harm than action.
You know, there may be. Though notice here that all this is about, you know, China vis-a-vis the U.S., the EU vis-a-vis the U.S. It's not China vis-a-vis Europe, for example. And so it would be sort of the U.S. position and the rest of the global economy that would be affected by this. There are provisions within the GATT or within the WTO where if you take safeguards, which is basically what President Bush had done, and you argue that you need to protect an industry for a while, you can do that. But you have to give back concessions for other products. So when you negotiate a trade agreement, you know, I let you sell me steel, you sell me whiskey, and so if you take away the steel concessions, I'll take away the whiskey concessions.
Yeah.
Right. And so what, you know, assuming that.
So you're saying President Trump always talks about, he doesn't like these big multi-country free trade agreements because the U.S., he says, always winds up getting taken advantage of. He likes one-on-one trade agreements, the U.S. with one other country at a time. But you're saying this is not that with China. This is just the U.S. taking a unilateral action with China, which is going to spark retaliation. Do I hear you right?
But it's limited retaliation. So they're allowed. The U.S. is allowed to take action, for example, with safeguards. And the EU, I think, has already indicated that they're going to treat this as a safeguards action. In that case, it just means that since the U.S. takes away market access, then the EU or China can take away a similar level of market access. It's tit for tat.
Right.
But it's just, you gave me something, okay, take it away, but then I'm not going to give it to you. Another thing to keep in mind, though, about multilateral versus bilateral deals, the reason the whole system was set up at the end of World War II, we have to go back to our grandfathers and great-grandfathers, right, was their sense was that they'd gone through a half century of conflict driven partly by colonial trading systems, big countries taking advantage of small ones. There was a bunch of things that, you know, they just didn't want to see again. And so there are parts of the multilateral system, like what's called MFN. You can't discriminate and give some countries a good deal and other ones a worse deal, that are meant to protect small countries from big ones ganging up on them.
Last question, and it's a really big picture question about this moment in history. There's an op-ed in the Times today, New York Times, by Ruchi Sharma from Morgan Stanley, which asks, is Trump starting a trade war? And it says the deepest fear is that steel and aluminum tariffs will echo the mistake of the infamous Smoot-Hawley tariffs of 1930, which provoked a global trade war and helped fuel the Great Depression. But he writes, the alarmists are getting a bit ahead of the story. Periods of deglobalization, when nations begin shuttering their borders to flows of trade, money, and people, tended to be slow processes over history, not sudden events. The last era of deglobalization actually began when countries turned inward after World War I, more than a decade before Smoot-Hawley and the Great Depression. It's important to view Mr. Trump's latest trade actions in that historical context. The suggested higher tariffs on steel and aluminum are too narrowly targeted to trigger a trade war, but represent another chapter in the evolving era of deglobalization. So writes Ruchi Sharma. So, Professor, how much do you agree with his take on history, whether it's necessarily a horror for there to be a period of deglobalization to correct some things after a period of massive globalization?
Yeah, so I think we're mixing globalization with the technical change that we've had. Again, back to this idea that we've broken up value chains, we've shut down integrated production, jobs have gone away because of that, communities have become distressed. It's not just global trade, right? So we had steel production and motor vehicles move from the north to the south in the U.S., textile production similarly. So it's not just global, it's also within the U.S.
And it's also closing the borders. And I don't want to get sidetracked by it, but in 1924, right in the period that Trump is writing about, the U.S. really closed the borders at that time, and they weren't really reopened until the 1960s.
This is true, and it's okay to get distracted because I think all of this is a bit distracting. There's just so much going on. But I think it's useful just to – I would agree broadly with the comment, but I'd say look at the crisis that we came out of and compare that to Smoot-Hawley. Okay, so sliding into the Great Depression, we did have an episode of escalating protection. In the Great Recession, that didn't happen, right? It was a resounding there was no sound. Nothing happened. Right. In a sense, the governments worked very hard to preclude that, and they worked together. And currently it may be that the White House doesn't feel cooperative. But I think broadly speaking, the major players who avoided us going into some protectionist spin during the Great Recession are still there. And I think there's an interest in keeping the system going, which is also why I don't think this particular step would lead to a global trade war per se. I think there will be tensions, but I think we've had those before. I think the system's engineered to sort of handle that pressure by containing it so that it's somewhat isolated. So, I wouldn't be so pessimistic. But I do think that this is the raw, that there's a real problem, but this doesn't fix it.
Joseph Francois, Managing Director and Economics Professor at the World Trade Institute at the University of Bern, capital of Switzerland, and he contributed to a report on the tariffs question released by the Trade Partnership. Thank you so much for coming on.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or Facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.